Longing. Related to loss is longing. Longing is not conscious wanting. It's an involuntary yearning for wholeness, for understanding, for meaning, for the opportunity to regain or even simply touch what we've lost. Longing is a vital and important part of grief. Yet, many of us feel we need to keep our longings to ourselves, for fear we will be misunderstood, perceived as engaging in magical or unrealistic thinking, or lacking in fortitude and resilience. This insight helped me make sense of something I've experienced a dozen times but never articulated, even to Steve. When you drive into San Antonio from Houston on I-10, you pass the exit from my grandmother's house. Sometimes, when I see the exit, I feel a pull inside me to get off the highway and go to her house just to sit in the backyard with her and drink iced tea. I want to touch her face and smell her house. The yearning is so physical and strong that I can actually smell the flowers in her yard and taste the tea. It's not rational. She's not there. Yet, it still takes my breath away. I once heard a friend say that grief is like surfing. Sometimes you feel steady and you're able to ride the waves, and other times the surf comes crashing down on you, pushing you so far underwater that you're sure you'll drown. These moments of longing can have the same effect as upwellings of grief. They come out of nowhere and can be triggered by something you didn't even know mattered. Feeling lost. Grief requires us to reorient ourselves to every part of our physical, emotional, and social worlds. When we imagine the need to do this, most of us picture the painful struggle to adjust to a tangible change, such as someone dying or moving away. But again, this is a very limited view of grief. On several occasions during her story, Claudia described feeling frozen, not knowing what to do, what to say, or how to behave. In the midst of her pain, she sat in silence with her parents, watching TV. Another good example of this is the couple who talked to me about navigating the grief they were experiencing after their oldest child left for college. Everything was off, the father told me. Nothing felt normal. I wasn't sure where to park my car at our house. He had his car with him, but I still left his space open. Setting the table for dinner was strange. Walking down the hall past his room was painful. We were completely lost and at the same time happy for him and proud of his accomplishments. We didn't know if we should laugh or cry. We've done a lot of both. The more difficult it is for us to articulate our experiences of loss, longing, and feeling lost to the people around us, the more disconnected and alone we feel. Of the coping strategies my research participants have shared with me, writing down experiences of heartbreak and grief have emerged as the most helpful in making clear to themselves what they were feeling so they could articulate it to others. Some participants did this as a part of their work with helping professionals. Others did it on their own. Either way, the participants talked about the need to write freely without having to explain or justify their feelings. It was these interviews that led me to look more closely at the idea of writing SFDs as part of the Rising Strong process. Rumbling with forgiveness. I've been engaged in a full professional rumble with the concept of forgiveness for 10 years. It has been glaringly absent from my work and all of my books. Why? Because I couldn't get to saturation. I couldn't find a meaningful pattern in all of my data. I got very close before I wrote The Gifts, but right as the book was going to press, I did 3 interviews, and what I learned during those interviews fell completely outside the pattern. Ordinarily, that would be fine. Most research methodologies allow for what we call outliers. If there are 1 or 2 small exceptions in the data, that's okay as long as the majority fall within the pattern. In grounded theory, though, there can be no outliers. Every story matters. And for your hypothesis to be valid, all your categories and properties must fit, be relevant, and resonate with your data. If something doesn't work, you're not there yet. It's incredibly frustrating, but sticking to this principle has not failed me yet. Several years ago, I was at church listening to Joe talk about forgiveness. He was sharing his experience of counseling a couple who were on the brink of divorce after the woman discovered that her husband was having an affair. They were both devastated by the potential end of their marriage, but she couldn't forgive him for betraying her, and he couldn't seem to forgive himself either. Joe looked up and said, "In order for forgiveness to happen, something has to die. If you make a choice to forgive, you have to face into the pain. You simply have to hurt." I instantly buried my head in my hands. It was as if someone had finally put the right sequence of numbers into a giant combination lock that I had been carrying around for years. The tumblers started turning and falling into place. Everything was clicking. That was the piece that was missing. Forgiveness is so difficult because it involves death and grief. I had been looking for patterns in people extending generosity and love, but not in people feeling grief. And at that moment, it struck me. Given the dark fears we feel when we experience loss, nothing is more generous and loving than the willingness to embrace grief in order to forgive. To be forgiven is to be loved. The death or ending that forgiveness necessitates comes in many shapes and forms. We may need to bury our expectations or dreams. We may need to relinquish the power that comes with being right, or put to rest the idea that we can do what's in our hearts and still retain the support and approval of others. Joe explained, "Whatever it is, it all has to go. It isn't good enough to box it up and set it aside. It has to die. It has to be grieved. That is a high price indeed." Joe says, "Sometimes it's just too much." I spent the next couple of years revisiting the data through this new lens of forgiveness, this time including an ending and the grief associated with that ending. I recoded and reworked my research, did more interviewing, and read through the literature. I wasn't surprised to find a growing number of empirical studies showing that forgiveness positively correlates with emotional, mental, and physical well-being. A strong and clear pattern was emerging. This pattern would be confirmed when I read The Book of Forgiving, The Fourfold Path for Healing Ourselves and Our World by Archbishop Desmond Tutu and his daughter, the Reverend Tutu. Archbishop Tutu served as the chair of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, and his daughter, Reverend Tutu, an Episcopal priest, is the executive director of the Desmond and Leah Tutu Legacy Foundation. The Book of Forgiving is one of the most important books I've ever read. I honestly did not have the words to adequately describe it to people after I finished it. It not only confirmed what I had learned about forgiveness from Joe, but also supported everything I've learned about vulnerability, shame, courage, and the power of story. The book outlines a forgiveness practice that includes telling the story, naming the hurt, granting forgiveness, and renewing or releasing the relationship. Archbishop Tutu writes, "To forgive is not just to be altruistic. It is the best form of self-interest. It is also a process that does not exclude hatred and anger. These emotions are all part of being human. You should never hate yourself for hating others who do terrible things. The depth of your love is shown by the extent of your anger." However, when I talk about forgiveness, I mean the belief that you can come out the other side a better person than the one being consumed by anger and hatred. Remaining in that state locks you in a state of victimhood, making you almost dependent on the perpetrator. If you can find it in yourself to forgive, then you are no longer chained to the perpetrator. Tutu continues, "You can move on, and you can even help the perpetrator to become a better person too." So, forgiveness is not forgetting or walking away from accountability or condoning a hurtful act. It's the process of taking back and healing our lives so we can truly live. What the Tutus found in their work on forgiveness validates not just the importance of naming our experiences and owning our stories, but also how rumbling with the process can lead to clarity, wisdom, and self-love. So often we want easy and quick answers to complex struggles. We question our own bravery, and in the face of fear, we back down too early. As Claudia works through her Rising Strong process and her dealings with her family, it's likely that she will need to rumble with forgiveness. I've never met anyone, personally or professionally, who didn't have to rumble with forgiveness. That includes self-forgiveness, too. Within families and in other close relationships, we love each other and we hurt each other. The question becomes, what has to end or die so we can experience a rebirth in our relationships? In one of my most difficult rumbles with self-forgiveness, I had to kill off the idea that being a shame researcher and knowing the pain inflicted by shame somehow exempted me from ever shaming other people. It seems counterintuitive, but my belief that I knew better than to shame someone sometimes left me blind to the hurt I caused and unaware of when I needed to make amends. That myth had to die, and I had to forgive myself for setting unattainable and ultimately damaging expectations. One of my most powerful experiences of forgiveness happened when I finally stopped running from the grief I felt about my family falling apart and started walking toward forgiveness. This process led to some of the toughest but most important deaths of my life. I had to bury my idealized version of my parents and see them instead as people with struggles and limitations, and with their own difficult histories and heartbreaks. As the oldest child, I tried to protect my siblings by keeping them as far away as I could from the front lines, which meant that I saw most of it up close. And what I saw then was rage and blame. But what I now recognize is the amount of pain, hurt, fear, and shame that my parents must have been feeling beneath that rage and blame. Back then, there was nowhere for my parents to turn and nothing they could do with that negative emotion. No one talked about that kind of stuff. There were no movies or television shows or national conversations about what was really happening within families. I can't imagine the pressure of losing everything, trying to keep a family of six afloat while having no support or permission to be afraid or vulnerable. My parents were raised in families where talking about emotions was way down at the bottom of the list of things needed for survival. There was no space for talking about emotions. Instead, it was just grind on, more of the same, push harder, yell louder. The death of the idealized version of our parents, teachers, and mentors, a stage in the hero's journey, is always scary because it means that we're now responsible for our own learning and growth. That death is also beautiful because it makes room for new relationships, more honest connections between authentic adults who are doing the best they can. Of course, these new connections require emotional and physical safety. We can't be vulnerable and open with people who are hurting us. The birth of this new relationship with my parents also forced me to bury the idea that if you're smart or talented enough, you can shield your family from your pain. If you are struggling, your partner and children are also in the struggle. And that's okay, as long as we acknowledge the hurt, provide everyone with a safe space in which to talk about it, and don't pretend that we can compartmentalize pain. Struggle happens. We give our children a gift when we teach them that falls are inevitable and allow them to participate in a loving, supported, Rising Strong process. Rumbling with compassion and empathy. What Claudia told me about the importance of seeing the world from the floor of the arena is central to the concept of compassion. The definition of compassion that most accurately reflects what I've learned from the research is from American Buddhist nun Pema Chodron. In her book, The Places That Scare You, Chodron writes, "When we practice generating compassion, we can expect to experience our fear of pain. Compassion practices daring. It involves learning to relax and allow ourselves to move gently toward what scares us. In cultivating compassion, we draw from the wholeness of our experience, our suffering, our empathy, as well as our cruelty and terror. It has to be this way. Compassion is not a relationship between the healer and the wounded. It's a relationship between equals. Only when we know our own darkness well can we be present with the darkness of others. Compassion becomes real when we recognize our shared humanity. Although Claudia is still in her rumble, she has told me that her experience is helping her to be more compassionate toward herself and more empathic towards others. By getting to know her own darkness, she is learning how to feel compassion for the darkness of others. The most compassionate people I've met and interviewed are people who not only have spent time face down in the arena, but also were brave enough to open their eyes to the suffering of others lying there with them. There are many debates about the differences between compassion, empathy, and sympathy. Relying on my data, this is what I've come to believe. Compassion is recognizing the light and dark in our shared humanity. We commit to practicing loving kindness with ourselves and others in the face of suffering. Empathy is the most powerful tool of compassion. It is an emotional skill that allows us to respond to others in a meaningful, caring way. Empathy is the ability to understand what someone is experiencing and to reflect back that understanding. It's important to note here that empathy is understanding what someone is feeling, not feeling it for them. If someone is feeling lonely, empathy doesn't require us to feel lonely too, only to reach back into our experience with loneliness so that we can understand and connect. We can fake empathy, but when we do, it's not healing or connecting. The prerequisite for real empathy is compassion. We can only respond empathically if we are willing to be present to someone's pain. Empathy is the antidote to shame, and it's the heart of connection. And last, sympathy. Rather than being a tool for connection, sympathy emerged in the data as a form of disconnection. Sympathy is removed when someone says, "I feel sorry for you," or "that must be terrible." They are standing at a safe distance. Rather than conveying the powerful "me too" of empathy, it communicates "not me," and then adds, "but I do feel for you." Sympathy is more likely to be a shame trigger than something that heals shame. The revolution. As Claudia continues to rumble with her story and discover her own delta and key learnings, I hope she will remember that choosing curiosity and connection rather than walking away or shutting down, while painful, is choosing courage. It's also the path to cultivating compassion, connection, and forgiveness. The brokenhearted are indeed the bravest among us. They dared to love, and they dared to forgive. C.S. Lewis captured this so beautifully in one of my favorite quotes of all time. He writes, "To love at all is to be vulnerable. Love anything, and your heart will certainly be wrung and possibly be broken. If you want to make sure of keeping it intact, you must give it to no one, not even an animal. Wrap it carefully round with hobbies and little luxuries. Avoid all entanglements. Lock it up safe in the casket or coffin of your selfishness. But in that casket, safe, dark, motionless, airless, it will change. It will not be broken. It will become unbreakable, impenetrable, irredeemable. To love is to be vulnerable." Connection doesn't exist without giving and receiving. We need to give, and we need to need. Chapter 8. Easy Mark. Rumbling with need, connection, judgment, self-worth, privilege, and asking for help. April. I called Amanda the minute I read about the lecture in the paper, Anne Lamott is coming to town. It must be a sign. My friend and former graduate student, Amanda, shares my enthusiasm for Anne's work, and we made plans to go hear her speak. Amanda is one of the smartest people I know, and she never shies away from a good theological throwdown. To this day, she and I carry on a constant, sometimes heated, but always loving debate about the nature of faith. Amanda, who comes from an evangelical background, was at the time beginning to explore other expressions of faith. Steve and I were wrestling with the idea of going back to church for the same reason many people do. We had young children and wanted them to at least have a foundation from which to make their own choices. Steve and I are both grateful that we grew up in families with strong spiritual foundations. But at some point, we felt betrayed by religion and we left. Neither one of us could really articulate how we felt until I heard Lamott referencing Paul Tillich and telling the audience, "The opposite of faith is not doubt. It's certainty." Steve and I didn't leave religion because we stopped believing in God. Religion left us when it started putting politics and certainty before love and mystery. As we took our seats in the high school auditorium before the lecture began, a jazz quartet began to play and pictures of homeless men and women faded in and out on a large screen. The event was a fundraiser for Lord of the Streets, an Episcopal church in Houston dedicated to serving the homeless. After a few minutes, Father Murray Powell walked on stage to talk about the work being done at Lord of the Streets before he introduced Lamott. One line in particular from his remarks cracked me wide open. He said, "When you look away from a homeless person, you diminish their humanity and your own." When you hear something like that, you don't have to fully understand it to know it's true. I know Father Murray well enough now to know it wasn't his intention, but the second he spoke those words, I felt the flush of shame. I suddenly thought, he's talking to me. I look away. As a researcher who has spent years studying the power of connection, I should understand better than anyone the human need to be seen. Yet I look away. Even when I roll down the window and hand someone on the street a bottle of water and a power bar, or maybe a dollar bill, I might flash a quick smile, but I don't make eye contact. And worse, I had no idea why. It's not that I'm afraid of seeing pain or hurt. I've worked at agencies for child protection and with victims of domestic violence and never looked away. I've sat across from violent offenders and grieving parents and not blinked. Why was seeing someone living on the street so hard for me? As I lay in bed that night, my curiosity showed up, as it often does, as a prayer. Specifically, I prayed for help in understanding why, despite knowing as much as I do about the importance of connection, I turn away so predictably. I woke up the next morning half expecting to have the answer. I even stayed still with my eyes closed, waiting for whatever insight might have come during the night to register. Nothing. Father Murray moved me to tears, and I prayed hard for understanding. But this time, understanding was going to take 9 months of curiosity, prayer, and rumbling. Rather than a single moment of insight, I experienced a collection of holy and unholy moments that would eventually bring me face to face with one of my greatest fears and, in the process, teach me exactly what St. Teresa of Avila meant when she said, "There are more tears shed over answered prayers than over unanswered prayers." June. There's nothing better than the warm embrace of belonging, that feeling you get when you're part of something you love or believe in. And there's no tangible sign of belonging greater than seeing your name and picture on an official membership roster. After a 2-decade hiatus from organized religion and a year-long search for the right community, Steve and I had finally found a great church for our family. Early one Saturday morning, we were embracing our big decision to join by having our family picture taken for the church directory. I woke up early, got myself ready, made breakfast, and put a good spit shine on the kids. For a moment in the car that morning, I felt pure joy. We were together. We were laughing. At one point, all four of us, even Charlie, who was just 2 years old then, were singing along to Alison Krauss's Down to the River to Pray. As we pulled up in front of the Grand Cathedral, the sun was shining through the spires and down onto the courtyard. I felt a huge sense of pride about belonging to a church that had such an impressive 150-year history in downtown Houston. A sacred place that was deeply spiritual, unapologetically questioning, and passionately committed to serving the homeless. I loved knowing that the very first members of our new church were spirited men and women who had left the United States to build a new nation, the Republic of Texas. As Steve parked, I stared out the car window thinking, this is my church. I'm a part of this history and community, just like the men and women who attended this church when they were running cattle down Texas Street. I was also excited because now we had a place to give back to, a place to make contributions to our community and to teach our children how to do the same. As soon as we parked the car, the kids jumped out and headed toward the fountain in the courtyard. I called after them. Don't get wet. Don't put your hands in the fountain. No dirty hands. It's picture day. Steve shook his head as if to say, good luck. As we walked past the front entrance and toward the side door, I noticed a stack of newspapers and a few pieces of trash under the awning. This is my church. That litter will not do. I walked over and grabbed the loose trash in one hand and some folded newspapers in the other and walked toward a city trash can. With every step I took, a terrible smell wafted from the trash. Reflexively, I held the trash up in my left hand and took a whiff. Nothing. Maybe some stale French fries. Then, with my right hand, I lifted the folded newspapers toward my face. Just as the smell made its way inside my nose, my mind calculated the weight, density, and feel of the stacked newspapers that were folded strangely into a triangle, forming a nearly perfect pocket. Oh my God, it's poop. Steve, help, it's poop. Oh my God, holy shit, someone pooped in here. I raced toward the trash can shouting. I threw everything in and shook my empty hands over the trash, trying to fling the germs off. Steve was literally bent over, laughing hysterically. It's not funny. Why are you laughing? Oh my God, holy shit, I am so grossed out. Steve struggled to get the words out. Stop saying it. Oh my God, I can't take it. It's so funny. Infuriated, I snapped back. What's funny? There's nothing funny. Steve stopped laughing just long enough to say, holy shit, get it? Holy shit. Then he started laughing again. I rolled my eyes and made a beeline for the restroom. After the fourth surgeon scrub and washing, I realized it was sort of funny. When I walked out, Steve was waiting for me with a repentant look on his face that was quickly replaced by another burst of uncontrollable laughter. For the next few months, I thought about that stack of newspapers every time I saw a homeless person, which is, unfortunately, pretty much every day in urban Houston. I thought about the indignity of having no place to go to the bathroom except a stack of newspapers in the entryway of a downtown church. I thought about the homeless people I had worked with in my career as a social worker, and how many of them were veterans, and how most struggled with trauma, addiction, and mental illness. I also thought about the dread that still washed over me whenever I got caught at a stoplight and found myself right next to someone asking for help. I still wasn't really looking, I mean, not in a meaningful way, and the newspaper incident made me wonder if it was related to my sense that I wasn't helping other people enough. My go-to response to discomfort is often, do more, help more, give more. Maybe I could start looking people in the eye if I didn't feel so much shame about not helping. So I ramped up my volunteering and stocked my car with Gatorade and granola bars. But it wasn't working. Something was still getting in the way of seeing the humanity outside my car window. September. Exactly 3 months after picture day at church, I was in Whole Foods picking up lunch for myself and a friend who was recovering from surgery. As I did a reconnaissance lap around the salad and hot food bars, I noticed a man watching me. He was a middle-aged white guy in a flannel shirt, dirty jeans, and mud-caked boots. He wore a cap pulled so low over his face that it almost covered his eyes. He looked as if he worked in construction. I probably wouldn't have noticed him, except that he was standing in one place, shifting his weight from foot to foot, and studying the hot food. We made eye contact. I flashed a quick, uncomfortable smile and looked away. Strangely, he grabbed a flip phone from his pocket and started talking. As someone who's deployed the phone decoy trick in awkward situations, I knew what he was doing. There wasn't anyone on the other end. My suspicions were confirmed when he stuffed the phone back in his pocket in mid-sentence as soon as I walked to the other side of the hot food bar. I filled a container with lentil soup for my friend. As I headed for the salad bar, I glanced up at the construction guy. Something seemed off. Every time I lowered my head to see under the sneeze shield and steal a glance at him, he looked away. When I caught him watching me, I looked away. I was pouring salad dressing into a little paper cup when I saw a commotion from the corner of my eye. The man had run up to the hot food bar and, with both cupped hands, scooped up pot roast gravy and roasted vegetables and then made a break for the door. The only other person nearby just stood there, holding her basket with one hand and covering her open mouth with the other. An employee ran over and asked what had happened. I explained, and he shook his head, quickly grabbed the large metal pan holding the remaining pot roast, and hurried back to the kitchen. I stared, unable to move. What the hell had happened? Did the man find a safe place to sit and eat his food? Or did he just eat it as he ran? I should have smiled at him. Why did I look away when he looked at me? Maybe he was trying to tell me something. I could have bought him a real lunch in a container with a fork. Had the food burned his hands? God, no one should ever have to do that for a meal. That was when I started wondering if my discomfort was less about not helping enough and more about privilege. Maybe I wasn't looking folks in the eye because I'm uncomfortable with my own privilege. I make more money now. My car starts every day. We don't get our lights turned off anymore. I'm not picking up extra bartending shifts to make the rent. No one looks at me at Whole Foods and wonders what I'm up to. I've had the great honor of teaching courses on race, class, and gender at the University of Houston, one of the most racially and ethnically diverse research institutions in the United States. I've learned enough about privilege to know that we're at our most dangerous when we think we've learned everything there is to know about it. That's when you stop paying attention to injustice. And make no mistake, not paying attention because you're not the one getting harassed or fired or pulled over or underpaid is the definition of privilege. I thought to myself, maybe looking away is about privilege. Maybe I need to think longer and harder about my choices and recognize that choosing whom I see and whom I don't see is one of the most hurtful functions of privilege. Acknowledging privilege and taking action on injustice require constant vigilance, but no matter how conscious I try to stay, privilege wasn't the only thing getting in my way. The rumble continued. January. Several months later, on a cold January afternoon, I received one of those calls, the kind that brings time to a standstill and, without warning, violently reorganizes everything. It was my sister Ashley. "Something's wrong with Mom. She passed out in my driveway. Something is wrong." I'm someone who chronically and compulsively rehearses tragedy, assuming that I then will be prepared when it actually comes. Or that it might never come because I'm ready for it. After all, I did my part. I sacrificed joy in the moment of feeling it to forestall future pain. Now I want what I'm owed. Less hurt, less fear, less panic. But trading joy for less vulnerability is a deal with the devil, and the devil never pays up. So all I felt in the moment as I listened to my sister's voice was sheer terror. Nothing can happen to my mom. I won't survive it. 30 minutes after that call, I was at the emergency room with Steve and Ashley. We were huddled together waiting for someone to tell us what was happening to our mother behind the heavy automated doors. There was no doubt in my mind that it was serious. The room beyond those doors was filled with too much commotion. Plus, it was written all over Steve's face. The good news in these situations is that Steve's a doctor, so he can translate what's happening. The bad news is that I've been looking into his eyes for 25 years, and I know when he's scared or worried. Again, I thought to myself, no one can come through those doors with that look on her face. I refuse to let anyone come through those doors with that look on her face. I refuse to accept that outcome. I can't do it. Finally, a nurse walked out, and without breaking her stride, said something to Steve about my mom getting a heart catheter. Steve was explaining to us how a heart catheter works when the doctor came out. My mom's heart had stopped. The electrical system that controls her heartbeat had shut down, and the default condition was a very low heart rate. They were moving her to the cardiac intensive care unit. This made no sense to me at all. My mom was healthy. She was young and active, she worked full-time, and she lived on black beans and spinach. The doctor explained that they had scheduled her for a surgery the next morning and that it would be a couple of hours before we could see her. We stayed at the hospital and waited. My other sister, Barrett, Ashley's identical twin, arrived from Amarillo, and my brother was on standby in San Francisco. Slowly, and outside of my awareness, my physical stance became more resolute. I don't know if it was in response to my own pain or to seeing my younger sisters in such deep fear, but my teeth clenched, my jaw hardened, and my eyes narrowed with focus. The tears stopped, my hunched shoulders straightened, and the armor began to lock into place. In a series of barely perceptible movements, choreographed by history, my arms slid around my sister's shoulders, and I grew taller. I became the protector, just as I had when I gathered everyone in my room while our parents fought. The same protector who intervened with my parents when I thought one of my sisters or my brother was in trouble. This was my role, co-parent. While I'm in it, I'm fierce. I am the protector. And unfortunately, I am the worst damn overfunctioner you've ever seen. In Harriet Lerner's book, The Dance of Connection, she explains that we all have patterned ways of managing anxiety. Some of us overfunction and others underfunction. Overfunctioners tend to move quickly to advise, rescue, take over, micromanage, and basically get in other people's business rather than looking inward. Underfunctioners tend to get less competent under stress. They invite others to take over and often become the focus of worry or concern. On the outside, overfunctioners appear to be tough and in control, and underfunctioners can seem irresponsible or fragile. Many of these behaviors are learned and line up with the roles we play in our families. It's not uncommon for firstborns to be overfunctioners, as is certainly the case for me. When we were finally allowed to see our mom, my sisters did their best, but they were barely holding it together. I, on the other hand, was unflinching. "What do you need from home?" I asked her. "What can I do? Who do I need to call from the office? What needs to be done at home?" Overfunctioner to overfunctioner, my mom and I came up with a long to-do list. When the doctor came in, he reached across my mother to shake hands with my stepfather, but I intercepted the handshake, introduced myself, and began drilling him for information. My stepfather took a step back and let me run the show. Afterward, we regrouped on the first floor of the hospital. The sprawling lobby at Houston Methodist Hospital is beautiful. Huge fresh flower arrangements sit atop perfectly appointed tables. Sculptures stand in the halls, and there's even a grand piano. It's wonderful, but weird. Every time I walk through it, I struggle to reconcile what feels like the lobby of a fancy hotel with all of the wheelchairs and people in scrubs. Standing beside the piano, I pulled out the list my mother and I had made and began to delegate the assignments. "Ashley, can you go to Mom's house and get all of her medicines? Put them all in a bag, including her vitamins. Barrett, I need you to call Jason and give him an update. We also need to get Mom some lightweight cotton pajamas." As I wrote down my sister's initials next to each item, I began getting nervous about the dwindling number of items left. Mom wanted a few things from the store, but that wasn't enough to keep me busy. You know what? Let me get Mom's medicines. I know where she keeps all that stuff. And Barrett, I should call Jason. He's scared, and it'll be a tough conversation. It's hard to be far away. I also know where to get some pajamas that button up the front. I studied the list and nodded my head, proud of my decision to reclaim the chores. Yep, this is much better. It's best if I do all these things. In the brief moment, it took me to change the initials and make new notes on the to-do list. My sisters had stepped back from our circle and were whispering to each other. When I finally looked up and saw them, they were holding hands and looking straight at me. What? What's wrong? What is it? I impatiently asked. Ashley said, "You are overfunctioning." Barrett quickly jumped in. "We can help. We know what to do." My body abruptly went limp, and as I dropped the list on the floor, I fell into the chair behind me and started sobbing. I was inconsolable. People often cry in the waiting rooms upstairs, but not in the fancy lobby. I'm sure I was making a scene, but I couldn't stop. My sisters had pierced my armor. It was as if 40 years of doing instead of feeling had caught up with me. Ashley and Barrett were also crying, but they held me and told me that we were going to be okay and that we were going to take care of one another and Mom. My stepfather, David, who had been watching this whole show for the past hour and the past 20 years, kissed us on the heads, accepted my apology for being so rude in the hospital room, and took off with the list. Once again, my mom's own history of rising strong was at play. Her choices and the work she had done on her own life didn't just spark my curiosity. They also transformed my sisters and my brother. Mom buys important books like Harriet Lerner's The Dance of Connection in bulk and gives us all copies. It's not subtle, but it's effective. My sisters and I were able to have this honest rumble because Mom had made sure we were exposed to ideas and information that were not available to her as a young woman. Looking at these responses through a vulnerability lens, it's easy to see that both ways of functioning are forms of armor, learned behaviors for getting out from under fear and uncertainty. Overfunctioning is, I won't feel, I will do. I don't need help, I help. Underfunctioning is, I won't function, I will fall apart. I don't help, I need help. My mom's surgery the next morning was successful, and by the afternoon, we were sitting with her in her hospital room. Someone brought in a pamphlet that explained her new pacemaker. The cover of the brochure featured a silver-haired couple in matching pastel sweaters riding bicycles. My sisters and I did an entire shtick about her new life of bicycling and wearing sweaters. We all laughed until we cried. Then we got kicked out. They told us to come back in an hour, so we decided to walk across the street to grab dinner at a fast food Mexican restaurant. It was already dark outside, and even though Houston's Texas Medical Center complex, where Mom's hospital was located, is the largest of its kind in the world, there's not much pedestrian traffic at night. So we stayed aware of our surroundings as we crossed the street. Inside the restaurant, Ashley and I were at the counter ordering when we heard Barrett's raised voice. I turned around to see a man wrapped in a blanket being pushed out of the restaurant and onto the sidewalk by a restaurant employee. In the scuffle, he had been accidentally shoved into Barrett, and she had yelled, "What are you doing?" to the employee. It was all over in less than a minute. It was confusing and upset all of us, especially Barrett. We tried to eat our food, but all the emotion of the day, combined with what had just happened, left us queasy. We left the restaurant and started walking back to the hospital. When we crossed the street and got closer to the hospital, we saw the man in the blanket again. He was African American, probably in his late 20s or early 30s. His face and hair were dust-streaked, and you could almost see a little cloud around him. He had the face of someone who had been hit a lot. After spending several years working in the domestic violence field, I recognized that look. Getting hit in the face repeatedly over time changes a person's bone structure. I tried to approach him to see if we could buy him dinner or help in some way. For a brief moment, our eyes met before he hurried away. What I saw in his eyes communicated something so painful that I could barely even register it. His eyes seemed to say, "This was not supposed to happen. This is not supposed to be my story." I started crying again, asking my sisters, "How does this happen to a man like that? How do we let this happen?" We were physically and mentally exhausted. We went back to the hospital and spent another 30 minutes with Mom until we were asked to leave for the night. The next morning, I arrived at the hospital early. I smiled as the automatic glass doors slid open because the grand lobby was filled with music. And not just any music. Someone was playing a resounding version of Memory from Andrew Lloyd Webber's Cats on the grand piano. As I rounded the corner in front of the valet parking desk, I caught a glimpse of the piano player. I couldn't believe what I saw. It was the homeless man from the night before. His blanket was spread over the piano seat, and his hands were moving across the keys. Desperate to validate what I was seeing, I turned toward the woman sitting at the desk and blurted out, "Oh my God, I saw him last night. I think he's homeless." She replied, "Yep, he only knows a couple of songs. He plays them over and over until the security guys kick him out." "But I don't understand. Where does he go? Who is he?" I asked. She continued to process the valet tickets. "I don't know, sweetie. He's been coming here for about a year." Just then, the music stopped. The security guards were telling the man to gather up his stuff, after which they walked him outside. I was still in shock when I got to my mom's room. She was sitting up and eating. She had her color back, and she was in a talkative mood. "You look like you just saw a ghost, Brene," she said. "It's worse than that," I explained. "I'm seeing real people, and I know they're trying to teach me something, but I don't know what it is." I told her the story about the church trash, the guy at Whole Foods, and the piano player. She put down her fork, leaned back, and asked, "Can I tell you a story about your grandmother?" I curled myself into a ball at the foot of her bed and listened. When my mom was in grade school, her family lived half a block from the railroad tracks in San Antonio. There was a viaduct, a small arched bridge that the train crossed, right at the end of their street. The grassy side of the small hill leading up to the tracks was covered with bushes and plants, providing the perfect place for what my grandmother would call hobos to jump from the boxcars. My grandmother kept 5 metal plates, 5 metal glasses, and 5 metal forks in a dishpan under the sink. She always cooked more food than the family could eat, and according to my mom, hobos would knock on their door on a pretty regular basis and ask for dinner. The men sat on the front porch or on the porch swing, and my grandmother, I called her Meemaw, served their meals on special dishes. When they were done eating, Meemaw would boil the dishes and store them back under the sink until the next group arrived. When I asked my mom how it worked, why Meemaw trusted them and why they trusted her, my mom said, "We were marked. The hobos used a system of markings on the curbs of the neighborhood to indicate who was safe and who wasn't, who might feed them and who wouldn't." I later found out that this may be the origin of the term easy mark. My mom explained that Meemaw trusted them for 2 reasons. The first was that the woman across the street had a brother who had returned from World War II and become a hobo. So Meemaw never thought of them as the other, because she knew hobos personally, and, more important, because she considered herself the other, too. She had lived through poverty, domestic violence, divorce, and her own alcoholism. She actually quit drinking when I was born. She didn't judge other people. Second, Meemaw had no problem with need. She wasn't afraid of people in need because she wasn't afraid of needing others, my mom explained. She didn't mind extending kindness to others because she herself relied on the kindness of others. My mom and I didn't need to unpack the emotion behind that story. We both understood exactly what Meemaw had that we didn't. The capacity to receive. My mom and I aren't good at asking for or receiving help. We are givers. Meemaw loved receiving. She got excited when friends dropped off fresh-baked pies or when I offered to take her to the movies. She didn't mind asking for help when she needed it. It also went without saying that at the end of Meemaw's life, when dementia had ravaged her mind, the kindness of others kept her alive and safe. When I got home that night, Steve and the kids were at a soccer game. I sat on the couch in the dark and thought about Meemaw and one of the most difficult experiences of my life. Her son Ronnie's death exacerbated Meemaw's mental and emotional decline. One of her neighbors called my mom to tell her that she was concerned about Meemaw, who had been walking up and down the block, wearing nothing but a long coat and cowboy boots, knocking on doors and asking the neighbors if they had heard about Ronnie dying. It was becoming increasingly dangerous to leave her alone. Between fears about her roaming the neighborhood, leaving lit cigarettes in ashtrays, and using the gas stove, we knew it was time. My mom, who was living in Houston, was scrambling to find the right facility. I was living in San Antonio at the time and trying to help as much as possible. Meemaw would occasionally stay at my apartment, but any time we took her out of her house, she'd become disoriented and anxious. Even before Steve and I were married, he'd sit with her on some evenings so I could go to work. During one of my final visits to her house before she moved to an assisted living facility in Houston, I noticed that Meemaw had stopped bathing. She wasn't clean. I drew her a bath and got out a clean towel, but she just stood there and smiled at me. "Take a bath, Meemaw. I'll be right out here. When you're done, I'll make us dinner." She just smiled and raised her hands above her head. She wanted me to undress her. I pulled off her shirt, kissed her on the forehead, and stepped out of the bathroom, hoping she would take it from there. I was 29 years old and terrified. I thought to myself, I don't know if I can do this. I've never even seen her without her clothes on. I don't know how to bathe someone. "Okay, get your shit together, Brené. This is Meemaw. She's bathed you 1,000 times. So I walked back into the bathroom, undressed my grandmother, and set her down in the old pink porcelain tub. She smiled and relaxed as I lathered her up and rinsed her off. When she leaned back and closed her eyes, I just held her hand. Of course, the dementia made her less inhibited and even childlike at times. But it wasn't her failing mind that made her unashamed. It was her huge, giving heart. She knew the truth. We don't have to do all of it alone. We were never meant to. As I thought back to that moment in Meemaw's bathroom, I knew exactly why I looked away. I was so afraid of my own need that I couldn't look need in the eye. The Reckoning. This story is a great example of how the Rising Strong process can stretch out over months, even years. The reason I call Rising Strong a practice is that had I not stayed curious after each one of these experiences, the rumble would have fallen apart. If I hadn't connected these separate incidents by the common discomfort each one provoked in me, I'd be no closer to understanding a key piece of how I engage with the world and the people around me. While there were several moments in this story that took my breath away, my reckoning happened at the Anne Lamott lecture. My face-down moment was hearing Father Murray articulate so powerfully how the choice not to see someone fundamentally diminishes our shared humanity. I'm not even sure I was conscious of that behavior before he spoke those words. It was a quiet moment. I didn't flinch or cry or get angry. You wouldn't have noticed me falling if you were watching me, but I felt it, and I was committed to understanding more before I left the auditorium that evening. Maybe part of the metaphorical power of Roosevelt's quote, "The credit belongs to the man who's actually in the arena, whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood," is that it's possible to feel our faces marred with dust and sweat and blood. when the arena is an emotional smackdown rather than a physical one. I felt beat up on the way home from the lecture. Father Murray shined a light into a dark, unexplored corner of my behavior, and I knew that what I saw had to change. The Rumble. My SFD started as self-talk in the car on the way home from the lecture, and it became the subject of a conversation with Steve when he walked in the door that night. I ultimately jotted down this in my journal. I'm not helping other people enough. I feel shame about how much I have and how little I do, so I can't look folks I should be helping in the eye. Do more. In this case, my SFD wasn't based on traditional confabulations, explanations that offered me self-protection and pointed blame towards someone or something else. But it was equally troublesome because it was made up of half-truths. I really do need to make sure that I'm giving and helping. I absolutely need to stay uncomfortably aware of my privilege. But after 6 months and three powerful experiences in which I had to confront my discomfort, I realized that the real reason I look away is not my fear of helping others, but my fear of needing help. My rumbles with shame, judgment, privilege, connection, need, fear, and self-worth taught me that it wasn't the pain or hurt that made me look away. It was my own need. Act Two is all about trying to find a comfortable way to solve the problem, until those options are exhausted and you have to walk straight into discomfort, the lowest of the low. Helping and giving are comfortable for me. I wanted to solve this issue by doing more of what I already do. When I look back at this Rising Strong example now, I think about how often we all try to solve problems by doing more of what's not working. Just doing it harder, grinding it out longer. We'll do anything to avoid the lowest of the low, self-examination. And as it turns out, I'm not so sure I was great at giving. How can we be truly comfortable and generous in the face of someone's need when we're repelled by our own? Wholeheartedness is as much about receiving as it is about giving. The delta did not mean rewriting my story completely, but rather adding and integrating new key learnings into an existing story I'd been telling myself that was misleading and incomplete. This meant looking back at my history. From a young age, I learned how to earn love, gold stars, and praise by being the helper. It was the role I played in my family, with my friends, and even with a few of my early boyfriends. After a while, helping became less about gold stars and more about my identity. Helping was the most value I brought to a relationship. If I couldn't help, or, God forbid, if I had to ask for help, what value did I bring? Over the years, I think I unconsciously developed a value system that helped me make sense of my role. A way to look at giving and receiving that made me feel better and soothed the pain of not allowing myself to ask for help. The axiom of that dangerous system was simple. Helping is courageous and compassionate, and a sign that you have it all together. Asking for help